Okay, we're going to begin our fifth session in our study of the history of dispensational, mid-acts, and premillennial theology. And we're looking at the period of time, basically, that runs after the time of Augustine, which was around 400 AD, going through the early period of the Reformation. And we're going to look at some of the history about the few and very highly suppressed teachers and movements that were existing at that time. Of course, after the time of Augustine, you really started to see the influence of the Roman Catholic Church getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And as we discussed last week, Augustine formalized the doctrine of amillennialism, in which the belief that Jesus Christ was not going to return to earth to establish his millennial kingdom, a literal millennial kingdom, in Israel, at Jerusalem, with the nation of Israel as the focal point. So when he adopted that doctrine of amillennialism, and then it became incorporated into the official dogma of the Roman Catholic Church, and then they use the influence of their power and their authority to suppress all other teachings, we lost basically any inkling of premillennial teaching from that point on until the period of the Reformation. So, as we pointed out, it was a very significant, very important time in terms of the loss of premillennial truth and dispensational truth for the body of Christ. But we're going to look at some movements tonight that are they're not real clear in church history, because so much of their teachings have been lost because of the suppression of the Roman Catholic Church. Basically, anything that opposed the official doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church, the writings of those teachers were suppressed, destroyed, and likewise, oftentimes there were writings that were combating that teaching from the Roman Catholic perspective, and many times they were written inaccurately, or they weren't paying attention as much to the actual doctrines of the people as much as they were paying attention to just refuting them in any way they can. And so, what we know of a lot of these groups is distorted. We don't actually possess any of their writings. We only have the writings of those who disagreed with them, and we know that many times those were not accurate representations of their true teaching. So, moving right along, if you can pull up your notes from today. Again, as we have the last few weeks, we start with the original opening graphic. And then if you'll go to slide 2, you'll see the date. It should say session 5, March 13, 2011. And we're going to look at the first of one of these movements that seems to have maintained some of the elements of scriptural teaching within them that was, in fact, suppressed and had a history of persecution while it existed. And one thing that we pointed out a few weeks ago, and I want to remind us of that, was there was a division already emerging within the early church between the Western church that was focused in Rome, or more and more was becoming focused in Rome, and the Eastern church in the Byzantine Empire, in Asia Minor and Greece, that part that eventually became the Eastern Orthodox churches. And again, unlike Roman Catholicism that was very highly centralized in Rome, the churches in the East, in Asia Minor, and the focal point being that of Antioch, but it didn't have that single central authority that existed in the West. And so much of the things that developed and have influenced us in our cultures came out of the thinking and the theology of the Western Roman Catholic Church. The Eastern churches, again, focused in Antioch, but without a central authority in the same way that the Roman Catholic Church was developing, it maintained a closer, it held more closely for a longer time to literal interpretation, to more scriptural really understandings of the various doctrines, a much more literal focus in the Eastern part of Christianity at that time, whereas the Western part was definitely going and following more of the Roman Catholic traditions as they were developing throughout time. And one of these movements that was in Asia Minor and primarily in Armenia, which is in northeastern part of Turkey, and of course modern-day Armenia, where there are a number of Christians there today, and no doubt if somebody could go there and really do some thorough study, they would be able to find out in their archives and in their churches and things a lot of the history of this movement called Paulicianism. Obviously, you see the link here in the name itself to the Apostle Paul. And this group, I've been doing some research just before the class started to try to get up to speed a little bit more on this group. When I first taught the class in my Sunday school, I kind of didn't have a full understanding of how deep and full and rich their history is. And so I was doing a little bit more review just a few minutes ago and realized that this is a movement that was very influential and had a strong was strong in that part of the world, and in turn actually had influence in some not too well known but break off groups that existed in Europe at that time. And so I'm not going to go into the full history of this of the Paulicianists, because I really have not been able to do as much study now that I know a little bit more about them as I wish I could. I'll give you some basic background, what I presented to the Sunday school class, and a little bit more. But I am going to put some links on the website tonight or tomorrow that will, if you want to do more research into this group, I found that this has a very complex and very rich history as a movement that really recognized a lot of scriptural principles. Now, this group, as far as I can tell, there's very little that I know about their dispensationalism. But what did seem to be very prominent in their teaching was that they had a strong emphasis on the teachings of Paul. And they gave prominence to Paul over Peter and to the 12 apostles, and they recognized some of the distinctions in the Pauline gospel that we recognize today. So anyway, to give you a little bit of background, the Paulicianists, as they came to be called, there is some tradition, and this may or may not be accurate, that they go back to an individual by the name of Paul of Samosata, who was a bishop in Antioch. And as I said, Antioch was kind of the center of Eastern Christianity. Of course, that's where the Apostle Paul himself focused his ministry during the time that he was alive. But this reference to this Paul of Samosata is not real clear. We don't know for sure if it went back that far. Where we do have clear references to the history of this group is 650 A.D. And this was about the same time that Islam was coming into existence, and they had some run-ins with the Muslims, the Paulicianists, and it was a growing movement, a large movement, a significant movement of Christians that broke off from some of the teachings that were emerging within the Roman Catholic Church and the rest of Christendom in what was left of the Roman Empire at that time. And so the Paulicianists were going back and forth between they were being persecuted by the church, and then sometimes they would actually side with the Muslims against the Roman Christians in some battles, and then there is evidence too that they were taken and put into exile, that they were repatriated into Europe, and that they became a seed for some of the other breakaway groups, or groups that never actually adopted Roman Catholic doctrine, that were living under the radar, so to speak, in Europe at that time. And there was a fair amount of persecution that they received. How all these groups came together is still very vague, because so much of their history has been lost. But a little bit of the history of the Paulicianists is that, as you see, their first emergence comes around 650 A.D., and I'm just reading here from some notes that I actually got from another class similar to this that is posted online, and I will put a link to these notes as well. And it's another pastor of a Grace Church who is teaching this to his Sunday school, and he's put these things online. And I have to admit, he's done actually even a more thorough job of general church history than I have, and so I commend him for what he's done. But it says here in 653, after the Muslim conquest of Syria, an Armenian deacon returning from captivity among the Muslims became a guest of a man named Constantine in the village of Manalis near Samosata, which is in Asia Minor near Armenia, northeastern part of Turkey. In response to Constantine's hospitality, and this Constantine was a man in this village. No, we're not talking about the Emperor Constantine. We're many hundred years past that. This Constantine, this individual who showed hospitality to this deacon that was coming back, who had been captured by the Muslims. In response to Constantine's hospitality, the deacon gave him, Constantine, a manuscript containing the four Gospels and the epistles of Paul. Rumors abound regarding Constantine's religious background, but what happened was, this Constantine, the guy who showed hospitality to the Armenian deacon, studied the scriptures, he renounced his religious past, and set up a movement to try to restore apostolic Christianity. In other words, this man, Constantine, in around 653 A.D., was given a copy of the scriptures. Whatever his religious background was before, which isn't real clear, he renounced that, and he made it his goal to try to revive the apostolic Christianity, the biblical Christianity. And that became the movement of what eventually came to be known as Paulinianism. It says Constantine changed his name to Silvanus, who was Paul's companion, Silas, another form of Silas, and began preaching for nearly 30 years in a place called Sibosa in Armenia. Silvanus had many converts from among the Catholics and the Zoroastrians. Over time, his group became sizable enough to attract the attention of the emperor, and an edict was issued in 684 against Constantine and the Paulician congregations. And so they adopted the name the Paulicians, which may likely have reference to the fact that they saw themselves as followers of the Apostle Paul. Then there was an edict against him by the emperor, because they were growing in popularity there in Armenia and that part of the Byzantine Empire. Then it says the execution of the decree was entrusted to an officer of the imperial court named Simeon. He had orders to put the teacher to death. This was Constantine, or the man who changed his name to Silvanus, and to distribute his followers among the clergy in the monasteries with the view of their being reclaimed. In other words, trying to bring them back into Orthodox, or what they called Orthodox Christianity. Simeon placed Constantine, the chief object of the priest's revenge, before a large number of his companions, and commanded them to stone him. So Constantine, who had changed his name to Silvanus, was ordered to be stoned by this officer, this imperial officer named Simeon. The soldiers refused to actually stone him. Instead of obeying, all dropped the stones with which they had been armed, except one young man, and Constantine was killed by a stone from the hand of this heartless youth, So one person threw a stone and actually killed this Constantine or Silvanus. Meanwhile, Simeon was so affected by the testimony of what he witnessed that after talking to the Paulicians, he converted to their faith. After spending 3 years at the imperial court, Simeon left his earthly position, returned to Sebosa under the name Titus, and became the successor of this Silvanus. And so, basically, the man who was in charge or was responsible for the execution of the founder of this Paulician movement in Armenia was so moved by the event where no one was going to stone him except one person who threw a stone at him, and then he started talking to these other believers. He himself was converted and became one of the primary followers or the primary teachers and leaders of this movement. And it grew, and as you can see, it was very prominent within the eastern part of the Roman Empire from 650 to 872, so a period of over almost 250 years. We have direct records, and it was a series of persecutions going back and forth. That sometimes they were recognized as accepted in the empire. At other times, they were persecuted. As I said, at times they sided with the Muslims because of the persecution that they were receiving. It's a very, very complex history, but well worth the study, and I'm going to spend some more time when I have an opportunity to learn more about this group. But what was unique about them is that it says the Paulicians accepted the four Gospels, the 14 epistles of Paul, 3 epistles of John, the epistles of James and Jude, and they also, it's said here at least, that they believed that they possessed an epistle to the Laodiceans. If they do, that would be quite remarkable. As you know, Paul refers to writing a letter to the Laodiceans. Nothing is known about that, if it actually existed or if that's just a rumor, but that would certainly be, if that existed in some monastery someplace in Armenia, Paul's epistle to the Laodiceans, that would be a remarkable discovery. But Paul refers to it in Colossians, that he tells that his letter to the Colossians should also be read in Laodicea, and the letter from Laodicea should be read in Colossae. So they accepted, for the most part, most of the New Testament that we have. It says, and this again is from the perspective of those who disagreed with them, from the most of the historians that write about the Paulicians were people that opposed them, but it says they rejected the Tanakh, which is also known as the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament. And then what is interesting is some of the doctrines which they are said to have rejected. And again, saying they rejected it, that coming from those who oppose them, doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't believe in it or accept it, but just as we understand that God wrote the Pauline epistles primarily to us, and that all of the Bible is for us but not to us, that may have been actually the view that they took as well. But they also rejected the title Theotokos, or Mother of God, for Mary, which was a growing movement in the church at that time. The influence that Mary was playing now in the Roman Catholic Church was becoming more and more significant at that time. Well, this group of Paulicianists rejected that idea. They rejected the use of icons in worship, which was becoming also much more common there, the use of images for prayer and adoration to the saints and these kinds of things. The Paulicianists rejected those ideas completely, and that was one of the main reasons why they were persecuted. There was a lot of opposition because the use of icons in worship was a very important part of the emerging Orthodox and Roman Catholic Church at that time. And then it says they also rejected the reverence for the cross. They looked upon as heathenish. In other words, worshiping the cross as an object, which was becoming more and more popular. The outward administration of the sacraments of the Lord's Supper and baptism they rejected. Their places of worship they called places of prayer. And although they were ascetics, they made no distinction in foods, and they practiced marriage. And so what we're seeing here in this in this group that emerged was a group that seemed to be clinging more closely to the scriptures. And their tradition that has been passed down to us was that it was based on a group that had received the Bible, on an individual who received the Bible, who read the Bible, he embraced it, and he set out to restore what he saw as biblical Christianity. As the group grew and expanded, it became involved in the politics of the day, and was large enough to raise up its own armies and soldiers, and was involved in the conflicts at that time. But what if you look at the church histories that were written, and I'm going to, as I said, I'm going to put some links on the web page where you can read them from sources that are available online. It seems to be that some of these Paulicians were expatriated from Armenia and were taken to Greece and to what is modern day Bulgaria, and some even believe that they may have been taken as far as France and northern Italy, and that these Paulicians became what were movements that were existing in Europe at the time, as I said, under the radar, kind of in remote villages, areas that were also known to have rejected a lot of the teachings of Roman Catholicism. Some of these maybe are ones that you're familiar with or may have heard the name. One is called the Bogomils, which is, I guess from what I understand, is actually where the term Bulgaria comes from. And they were repatriated from Armenia, put into modern-day Bulgaria, and they existed there for several hundred years. And there are references that can be found in history to these groups that were existing that were not Roman Catholic, even as Roman Catholicism grew. And they existed for several hundred years, even up until the time of the Reformation. As a matter of fact, in 1828, when the Russians took over Armenia, that when they went in there, they actually discovered that there were still existing, as late as 828, practicing Paulicianists who had not adopted the Orthodox religion that was surrounding them, but they still were maintaining a lot of their original teachings. And there is some historical records of a man who investigated them at the time, a historian, looked at some of their teachings and came away with the conclusion that they were really very much of a simple Christian movement that followed the scriptures and had a high reverence for the scriptures. And so that is how much of that spread into Europe. Another group called the I cannot pronounce this quite right, but Albigenus or something like that, that existed in France, seemed to have been linked as well to these Paulicians that were repatriated, and or that they were just part of the commerce that went on in that part of Europe at the time. And then another group that I would encourage you to do your own research on this. I've only been able to scratch the surface, but you might be familiar with the name when I mention it here, is the Waldensians. And they were a group that never adopted the Roman Catholic teaching in northern Italy. They were in the high altitude regions at the foot of the Alps in northern Italy. Again, they were called the Waldensians. I don't have them in my notes, but I will just type the name here if you want to do a search on the internet and find out some things about them. Interesting, a personal experience I had about the Waldensians that I think not necessarily the first time I'd heard of them, but I met a Christian man, a grace believer, when I was visiting a church in Florida at one time, and this man had married, he was an American, but he had married an Italian woman when he was in Italy during World War II. And she had been Roman Catholic, but she was from that region of Italy that was populated by the Waldensians. And she talked to me. At that time, she was probably in her 80s, an older woman. But she talked to me about the history of the Waldensians, at least from the traditions from that era. And their traditions are that they, as a movement, go all the way back to apostolic days. But they were isolated in the small villages near the Alps in Italy, and they were able to be separated enough that they were never forced to adopt Roman Catholicism until I think around the time of the Reformation that there were very strong inquisitions against them, and then they were forced and many of them were forced to convert to Roman Catholicism. But they did exist, these offshoot groups that continued, as I said, under the radar of the Roman Catholic Church throughout church history, all the way up until the time of the Reformation, when of course there was an open split and people were able to freely go against the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church. So it's a very just an interesting sidelight there about the Waldensians. And so, as I said, this is something that I would encourage anyone here who's listening to do further research on their own. I've only scratched the surface, and especially these Paulicianists, they have a very interesting, a very in-depth, very full history, and I've only given you a little bit of introduction. But what we do see is that even during the age of the growth of the Roman Catholic Church and the domination of the Roman Catholic Church, that there were still these biblical groups that were existing that were able to continue maintaining scriptural practices throughout that time. If you go to slide 4, we just have a very brief statement that somewhat summarizes the entire period of the Middle Ages especially in European church history. It says the Middle Ages were a time in which premillennialism, literal interpretation, dispensations, and an Israel church distinction were largely absent from theological discussion, or they went underground. It was that period of time in which there just was not any opportunity for anyone to discuss these things, and so any mention of premillennial ideas was immediately squashed, immediately suppressed. Writings were destroyed. And so we see that's probably the main reason, not probably the main reason, definitely the main reason why it took so long for the teaching of dispensationalism, premillennialism, mid-Acts dispensationalism to reemerge in the Christian church, because for 1,000 years before the Reformation, from the time of Augustine until the time of the Reformation, these truths were suppressed. They were held down. They were not allowed to be taught or propagated in any way. There was, however, one significant exception, and you're going to look at this. If you look at slide number 5, it talks about an individual by the name of Joachim of Fiore, who was in Italy. He was a monk in Italy. He lived from 1135 to 1202. And you're going to look at these ideas and say, you know, what in the world does this have to do with dispensationalism? This is so far from anything that we understand as dispensationalism. He just sees history being divided into three periods. And he calls it the Age of the Father, the Age of the Son, and the Age of the Spirit. And again, you know, that's not what we understand to be dispensationalism, but what is unique about it is a first inkling of a recognition of different periods in which God was working, and he is also giving the first ideas of premillennial thought, the first ideas of the idea that there is going to be a literal millennium and that it's going to be here on earth. And so even though this looks so different from what we understand as dispensationalism today, classic dispensationalism, given the context that he was living in and the suppression of any ideas of a literal millennium on earth, this Joachim of Fiore was recognizing in initial form that God worked in a sense, a dispensational scheme, and that there was a future dispensation on earth to look forward to. And I'll just read the notes that I have here. A notable exception to the lack of premillennialism in the medieval Roman Catholic Church, the notable exception to normative medieval eschatology is found in Joachim of Fiore, a Cistercian monk who to an extent stressed premillennial themes. Joachim divided Earth's history into three periods. He assigned each age to a particular person of the Trinity as guiding the principle of that era. The first era was the Old Testament history and was according to the age of the Father. The current age of the Church was the age of the Son, and still in Joachim's future age was that of the Spirit. Now you'll notice that he died in 1202, but he saw that the third age, the age of the Spirit, was going to begin in 1260. I don't know what the significance of that date was. For Joachim, 1260 was to mark the end of the second period and the beginning of the third and final golden age of Earth's history. Joachim was unique in expecting an era of spiritual bliss coming after the coming of Antichrist, but before the end of history. Nevertheless, he was not a true millennialist. And so he did not see that Christ was going to come and establish this, but it says he believed that the three status evolved organically like the trees that they symbolized. And so, in other words, he was saying that the age of the Spirit was going to come in primarily through the church again. It's somewhat a proto post-millennial kind of thing, that the church was going to bring in this period of millennial bliss. But nonetheless, you're seeing the first initial type of breakaway from this idea that was existing. Now, his ideas were never widely accepted, and he was, I don't know that he was ever condemned by the Roman Catholic Church, but he was never fully embraced. He's a name that most of us have never heard of, but he was significant because it says, as the last point on slide 5 says, some scholars say that a millennialist tradition can be traced from him to the Reformation. In other words, there were people that were aware of his writings who were looking at them and using them as a basis for some idea of a millennial kingdom that was going to be established on the earth. Now, I have here I have access to a bibliography that was written by my teacher when I was at Grace Bible College, who has done a much more scholarly study on this subject, particularly of premillennialism, and that's Dale DeWitt. And he shared with me a portion of the work that he is doing that he hopes someday to publish. But one of the things that he did was he did a survey of premillennial works from the time of 1550 through 1849, and categorized them and counted them, how many were published that we know of that are in existence that we know of, and he broke them into 50-year periods. What he found was from the period of 1550 through 1599, so we're looking at right after the Reformation at that he was only, that they could only find six studies of millennialism or of references to Revelation or eschatology, premillennial ideas. So there were six of them published in that 50-year period from 1550 to 1599. And that remained pretty consistent, 1600 to 1649, 12, 1650 to 1699, 16, 1700 to 1749, 11, 1750 to 1799, 12. And then from the period of 1800 to 1849, that number jumped to 33. And that is about the time where premillennial ideas really started to catch on. And then from that point on, there would be multiple ones. And so it was after the Reformation and roughly about 200 years after the Reformation, that things were able to really gel in people's minds, where they were able to see these premillennial ideas and adopt them. Now, of course, if you can look on now to slide number 6, it's just a slide that reminds us of the date of the Reformation. October 31st, 1517 is obviously the Reformation was beginning prior to that, as many of the people that we remember as the leaders of the Reformation were already beginning to study and become dissatisfied with the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church. But what was so significant about that date, Martin Luther went to the church door in Wittenberg, Germany, and he posted his 95 theses and in which he disagreed with the selling of indulgences, and that was where he took his stand, and essentially from that point on the Reformation started. And that break with the Roman Catholic Church is monumental in church in human history. The significance of that is incredible. So much of what we know today, our lives have been influenced. Even the secular world has been influenced tremendously because of the Reformation. Another thing, if you remember the chart that I put there last or 2 weeks ago with the outline of church history, you remember that just before the Reformation, one of the most significant events that took place then was the invention of printing. Printing made it possible for books now to be mass-produced, and they became available on a level and at a scale that had never been known before in the history of mankind. Actually, we're going through a very similar period in human history right now with the advent of the internet. It's a mega leap in availability of information. What the internet has been to our generation, printing was to the generation prior to the Reformation. And the Reformation probably would not have taken place without the invention of the printing press. And by making the scriptures primarily, and also the writings of these people available to the mass of population, and with it an increase in literacy and so many other things, it opened doors for social changes that could never be changed. So October 31st, 1517 marks the beginning of the Reformation, and it opened the possibility now for some discussion. But if you look at slide number 7 now, you'll see that the early reformers, the primary movers and shakers of the Reformation, they did not accept premillennialism. And of course, without a premillennial idea, a return of Christ, you would not be able to have the dispensationalism. From the Lutheran Augsburg Confession, which is the formal confession of the Lutheran Church, it says it condemns those who scatter Jewish opinions that the godly shall occupy the kingdom of the world. Which obviously is a reference to the millennial kingdom. Likewise, the Swiss reformer Heinrich Bullinger, who wrote the Second Helvetic Confession, which reads, "We reject the Jewish dream of a millennium or the golden age on earth before the last judgment." John Calvin wrote in the Institutes, his major work, that millennialism is a fiction that is too childish either to need or to be worth refutation. The Anglican Church, in their Anglican articles, formalized a statement against premillennialism. It's observed in the 41st of the Anglican Articles, written up by Thomas Cranmer in 1553, described the millennium as a fable of Jewish dotage. And so all of these quotes show that the main movements of the Reformation were emphatically opposed to any kind of premillennial ideas. And so again, even though and many times they put down any kind of opposition just as fiercely as the Roman Catholics did. I mean, we know from the history that 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 the Lutherans and the Calvinists in Switzerland, in Geneva, they were just as strong to anyone that opposed them when they had the authority of the state behind them. And so if they were going to oppose premillennialism, it was going to be very, very hard for anybody to say anything against it and to bring up these ideas. There were, of course, some that had some premillennial leanings. There were the Anabaptists, the Huguenots, a group called the Bohemian Brethren, and they taught some premillennial views, and though they were denounced by the Reformers, it says here that Michael Servetus taught a Kielistic view. Kielism was another word for premillennialism. Though he was denounced by the Reformers as a heretic and executed in Geneva under Calvin's authority. A few of the mainstream accepted it, but basically it was rejected by most of the mainline denominations that were associated with the Reformation. Slide number 8 shows that there was one exception, 1582, early part of the Reformation. A man by the name of Giacopo Brocardo wrote a work on the Apocalypse of Revelation that appeared in English in 1582. He says he was a tireless exponent for the three status and Middle Advent doctrines. He believed the status of the Spirit had begun with Luther's preaching. And then he divided the status of the Spirit. He must have accepted the three views of Joachim of Fiore, and the last being the status of the Spirit, but he believed that it began with the preaching of Luther, the introduction to the age of the millennium. And he says, and then he divided that stage of the millennium into six stages, sub-ages. The sixth age was to extend from the massacre of St. Bartholomew to the final overthrow of the papacy. And as we will see, as premillennialism emerged, of course, most of the Reformers saw the Antichrist to take the form of the Roman Catholic Church. And as we get into next week, we look into postmillennialism, we will see that that many of those postmillennial teachers, they saw that the thing that was keeping back the millennium was the existence of the Roman Catholic Church. When the Catholics could be defeated or the papacy could be destroyed, that would bring in the final millennium on earth. Not an apocalyptic return of Jesus Christ, but it would be the church that would overcome the what they saw as the heresies of the Roman Catholic Church. And then it says the seventh age, he divided this third status of the Spirit, or age of the Spirit, from Fiore, into seven stages. The sixth was this period, and I tell you, I don't know what the massacre of St. Bartholomew is. I'd have to look that up. And then the seventh age would constitute the millennium of Revelation 21. So we're looking at somewhat of an emerging post-millennial view. Then just says here, I'm going to give a little read from my notes on the history of early dispensationalism. Although Darby was the first to systemize dispensationalism, the rudimentary features can be found prior to the 19th century, especially in the early church and 300 years prior to Darby. Opponents often debate a pre-Darby heritage, but the writer of this says, I think the evidence does support our claim that there are historical and theological antecedents to the modern system of dispensationalism. He says that the fathers, the church fathers, distinguished between the church and national Israel, talking about the pre-Nicene fathers that we talked about 2 weeks ago. They recognized distinctions among the differing peoples of God throughout biblical history, and they believed in the literal fulfillment of covenant promises in the earthly kingdom. The contemporary dispensational position on Israel and the church is primarily a refinement and not a contradiction of the position of the anti-Nicene church fathers. There was an individual by the name of Pierre Pioré. He published a book in 1687 called The Divine Economy, and he divided God's history into seven stages. He called it infancy, which was from creation to the flood, and then the second age was that of childhood, which was to Moses. third was he called adolescence, was from Moses to the prophets. The fourth was youth, from the prophets to the coming of Christ. The fifth was manhood, which was sometime after that. And then he had a period of old age, which was the time of man's decay. And then he had the renovation of all things, which was a millennium. This was a man by the name of Pierre Poiret in 1687, who was beginning to see some of these ideas. And then slide number 9, in conclusion, a name that many of us are familiar with, Isaac Watts. He's a famous hymn writer, an English hymn writer, lived from 1674 to 1748. And he saw several successive periods or ages of the world, which were contained in the duties which God expected from men and the blessings which he promised them. And we can see there was a general correlation in these ideas with that of our modern-day dispensationalists. So you can see the link there and the association, the development of these dispensational ideas now after the Reformation. We're looking at about 160 years after the Reformation. And he saw these six periods of time: the dispensation of innocence from Adam to the fall, or Adam after the fall, then the Noahic dispensation, from Noah until Abraham, the Abrahamic dispensation, the Mosaic dispensation, and the Christian dispensation, or the church. So we're seeing here in Isaac Watts the initial recognition of these dispensational principles. They're being restored now. So in conclusion, I just want to wrap up the things that we talked about today. We were looking at some of these, like the Paulicianists, and I would really encourage you to do your own study on this. I have only scratched the surface as to the deep, rich history of this group. And I believe there's probably a lot more that can be known about them. But they appeared to be a group that did not accept the teachings of the emerging Roman Catholic Church or even the Orthodox churches that were around them. They were in Armenia. They seem to have existed up until the 19th century. There were remnants of them found. They seem to have been the predecessors through migration into Europe of some of the small groups that existed in Europe up until the time of the Reformation that opposed the Roman Catholic Church. So there were groups out there that did not buckle under, that tried to maintain a scriptural stance. They were minority, they were barely known, but they did exist. And so they were there. Then throughout the Middle Ages, any idea of premillennialism was violently suppressed by the Roman Catholic Church, with the exception of this one man, Joachim of Fiore, who started to suggest that there was going to be a millennium, a future time of eternal bliss. And then moving along into the Reformation, and then, of course, the Reformed churches, the major Reformed churches, Lutheran, Anglican, and Calvinist churches, continued to reject premillennialism, and so that still held down any strong discussion about the issue. And then once there was more freedom, even within the Reformed churches, then you started to see the emergence of some premillennial ideas. Next week, we're going to get into even more detail about some of these things. We're going to look at postmillennialism, which is really, was for me, a very fascinating subject. And the influence that it had in human history, and it's a first stage towards premillennialism. If you have amillennialism, looking at the scriptures from a postmillennial view is a first step towards recognizing the premillennial truth. But postmillennialism was tremendously influential, especially in American church history. As a matter of fact, were it not for the postmillennial theology, there would be no United States of America, probably. Or they wouldn't have been able to get the support of the masses of people. Postmillennial ideas were incredibly significant, and much of what we see in our culture in the United States was the result of postmillennial ideas. Are there any questions? Okay, well, I appreciate all you folks that tuned in. And again, I would encourage you, if you have any questions or anything that you'd like to bring up, just feel free to ask. I'll release the mic here for a minute.